The advertising world can be a battlefield when it comes to finding opportunities for career advancement. Roles are largely competitive, and moving upward quickly can be a challenging task. But I found someone who gamed the system in a legitimate way. Since 2017, Anas Ghazi has acted as the CEO of WPP's Data Alliance and also a growth officer for Kantar. Most shocking about Anas's current role is the fact that he's only been in the advertising and marketing industry for a total of 6 years. Anas speaks with us about his original career aspirations, his fascination and dedication to harnessing the power of data, and the sacrifices he's made to secure a meteoric rise. Our episode on how to growth hack your ad career starts right now. Anas, thanks for joining us today for a recording of Ad Tech Unfiltered.
Thank you for having me.
Not surprisingly, you have helped a lot of organizations grow fast and far, and that's also reflected in your career, and that's why we're having this conversation today. So before we get right into it, can you give us a little bit of background on who you are and what you do?
Wow, who I am and what I do. Big questions.
Yeah.
So my name is Anas Ghazi, as you mentioned, and my current role at Kantar, I like to use my superhero name. I'm an agent of growth. And what that means at Kantar is three main things. First, growth is broken out into how do we drive the business to create more business. So it's identifying opportunities with our clients as we partner with them to create new solutions, create new capabilities where they could reach their end consumer. The other piece of growth for us is very much around the way we position and speak about ourselves in the industry. Because in the last year, Kantar itself has gone through a transformation where there used to be multiple brands to now being one brand. And I'd say the third piece of growth as we think about it is, how do we continue to show Kantar as a purpose-driven brand? So how do we align and connect with industry affiliations and partnerships that very much speak to the core essence of who and what Kantar is?
You're doing a ton of exciting stuff at Kantar, but I think such an important part of your story is understanding the origins of where you came from. And if this podcast is going to be about growth hacking, your career is very much a reflection of that. So can you take us to the very beginning where you started, and maybe before you even start addressing that, can you tell me how many years you've been in the industry?
So I've been in the industry a total of 6 years. Which compared to most, I'm an infant, but I am a firm believer of talent over tenure. And we live in a world and an industry where you have 19, 20-year-old CEOs and CTOs who have just as much talent and charisma, and they're able to drive multi-billion dollar industries. So 6 years in the industry. Prior to that, I did 6 years in financial services. Actually, down the street at TransUnion, 555 West Adams. From there, I went to American Express. And from American Express in New York is when I joined WPP.
When you first got out of college, I want to dig real deep here, actually, because
oh,
I think this is it's really important for people to understand that the shifts are not miraculous as much as it might seem like it's this incredibly fast trajectory, which it was. There's a lot of things that you did to get yourself to where you were.
So I would have to say, coming out of college, I was one of those guys in undergrad at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, where I was the guy who had five majors because there was so much that I wanted to do. But while I was at Northern Illinois University, I was also an actor. I actually had started acting in the city here in Chicago when I was 14, 15 years old. And the entire time, I actually wanted to be a professional actor. And I remember telling my mom, I was like, Mom, I'm going to be an actor. And my mother's response in old Indian Pakistani fashion is, my only son is not going to wait tables. So I literally graduated in May, and then I started grad school in June at Northern Illinois, and I got a graduate degree in information systems. And it was great. It was extremely interesting learning about tech and so forth. And just my undergrad in communications and a graduate degree in information systems was a great compliment. But when I was done with it, just as I was graduating from grad school, my grandfather had passed away. And at that point in time, I had a job offer with a bank out of state. And my intuition just told me I would regret taking the job offer. So I took a year off and I began acting full time. I had an agent here. David O'Connor was down the street. I was in Chicago the entire week just auditioning, acting, doing free gigs, doing multiple shows, doing readings at the Rossica Theater Company. I just did all of it because it's what I wanted to do. It was what I was passionate about. For me, I felt like I was in a place that if I ever had to sacrifice the integrity of what I was doing, I had an education, I could go back to that. So I was acting full-time, and I did pilot season in Chicago and so forth, and I thought, this is it, big break, actor, I'm never going to corporate, but I needed health insurance. And so I ultimately, through connections, ended up with a job at TransUnion, and I picked TransUnion only because they were down the street from O'Connor Casting. And so I did that, and it was literally, my mindset was, my part-time job is being at TransUnion, and I got hired as a data engineer. And I was like, my main job is acting, so I would literally sneak away and go audition, do multiple auditions a day, because in my head, I was like, this is just paying the bills, I'm going to be an actor. But it was an interesting time for me as an actor as well, because it was post 9/11, and I had been, like, my card was ethnically ambiguous, so I played all sorts of people, Latino, Sardinian, Indian, Pakistani, Puerto Rican, you name it, I've played it. But at that time, post 9/11, the types of roles I started to get were very typecasted. And the straw that really broke the camel's back was, I was asked to audition for a TV show to play a Pakistani terrorist. And I was really hesitant to do the audition. My agent's like, just do it. You're not going to get casted for it anyways. So I was like, all right. So I went through and I did the taping. They sent it off to LA, did another taping, sent that off to LA. The casting directors came out, continued to audition until I actually booked the role. And I was like, what am I doing? And around that time, my nephew was just born. And I was at TransUnion and I was just going back and forth. I was like, I don't know if I should take this gig or not. And a colleague of mine, she came in late to work. And I was like, why are you late? And what she said to me, she said, there was this guy. He looked sort of like you, and he had like this terrorist look in his face. And so I got off the train. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what does that mean? And then it just dawned on me that I was doing the art for the sake of art, not because I want to perpetuate stereotype. And thinking about my nephew, I was like, I cannot leave this world worse than I found it. So I turned down that role. My agent was livid. And I explained to her, I was like, this isn't acting. You're asking me to play a Pakistani guy who's a terrorist. I was like, I'm half Indian, half Pakistani. I was like, it's not acting. I was like, someone else can go do the role because for them it'd be acting. For me, it is perpetuating a stereotype. So I got released by my agent because she also lost a lot of money in the process.
Sure.
But I was like, I'm just not going to do that. And as that was happening, my career at TransUnion, which was an interesting turn because at TU, when I got there, what I had asked the recruiter was, is there any programming involved? She said, not at all. I get there and day one, it is all COBOL, mainframe, SAS, SigSort, and I was in shock. In the beginning of it, I was terrible. I'll be the first to say it. But there was this competitive spirit, and I had good mentors along the way who really kept with me. And I retrained myself how to program through connecting up with my roommate from undergrad and so forth. On the weekends, I'd go in and I'd recode, I'd test my code and make sure it was all good. And I actually became good at it. And in that year that I had been acting, all of my fraternity brothers or my friends, they were all talking about 401ks and holidays, and I had nothing to contribute. And while I was at TU, all of a sudden, I was part of that. I liked what I was doing. I liked this idea of taking data and reaching people for acquisition campaigns and loyalty campaigns, and what does it mean, and just having that professionalized life. And I was like 6-8 months in after this incident with this TV show, and I realized I hadn't auditioned. And it was just that seamless that one chapter ended and another one began.
So let's jump into that even a little more deeply. One thing that's very clear is you were living two lives. You were living two professional lives. And incidentally, I think that could also be informed by the fact that when you're the child of immigrants, you oftentimes naturally live multiple lives.
You do. And being a child of an immigrant, and I think about this a lot, especially in recent times. I think about my mother, for example. My mother has lived in four countries. And you're forced to live two separate lives because coming from an immigrant background, regardless of how well your ancestral family is doing in your native countries, when we come to countries such as these, we start from ground zero or ground negative one. I'd say our parents end up starting at ground negative one because they're not as familiar with the language. The culture is completely foreign. My parents were super young when they came to this country. And then my mother, by the time she was 28, she had had five children and was widowed. And this double life comes from this piece of my mom in particular, her wanting security for me. Security tends to come in technical fields. It doesn't come in fields of creativity, or at least that was the mindset. And so here I was, my mother has been my number one fan, drove me to all my auditions here in Chicago at Lily's Talent and all the rest of it. But when it came down to professionalizing, she was like, you need to be able to put food on the table for yourself. And you have to have that level of security because we didn't have that luxury of saying, hey, yeah, you could just go be a starving artist and it's cool. So even though I was supported in being creative and like I love to write and my mother's like, go write, there was always this piece of, well, you're going to have to professionalize and go do it. You can go act as a side hobby. And when it came to that point where I was like, Mom, I was like, it's not a side hobby anymore. I'm booking work. I've got an agent and all the rest of it. Then it was, no, you know, you got to pick one. And I do believe you do have to pick one because there comes a point in time in life where you've got to commit. I couldn't commit to moving to LA because I knew it was going to be too hard for me. And in all actuality, the reason I wanted to be an actor, it was all for the wrong reasons. It wasn't for the right reasons. It was the adulation. And part of it was also to experience different characters. That was actually a big part of it, which I almost feel like that's what drove me into advertising, is understanding motivation. And that was the part I loved. And I realized I was getting that from different areas of my life. And I didn't have to be an actor to be that. And I was able to be at peace with myself by knowing that I had a decent amount of savings and I had a life that I could rely on.
So there's this cross-tabulation, right? You said that you wanted to feel motivated by these characters and they could inform the way that you would professionally work. And then you found that you could do something similarly through the exploration of audiences and humans and their differing interests. So to get back on path with thinking about TransUnion, something I feel like we briefly glossed over is why you went to TransUnion in the first place. Why did you decide to apply there? And what did they tell you you were going to do?
It was actually through a fraternity connection that I got the job at TransUnion. I'll be very transparent. And I picked it because it was down the street from my agent and from David O'Connor Casting in the West Loop. That was it. Like, it could have been a bubblegum factory and I would have been like, yep, that's the place I'm going to work because it's just down the street. Because at that point in time, the mindset was, I'm just going to go. I'm auditioning. I'm going to be out of here in 6 months. These people don't even know it. I'm gone.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really even realize what I was getting into. The one thing I thought it was going to be like a BA role, and that's how HR had explained it to me. But when I got there with my entire class, it was all coding.
And by BA role, you mean?
I meant like a business analyst type role. I will say what was humbling for me when I got to TransUnion was I'd started working when I was about, 25? So I was older, and there were... Or a little older, I guess. It's all relative. But I was 25, but everyone else was 22. And so here I felt like a 50-year senior at TransUnion with these kids who were just coming out of college. I was like, man, I've got 3 years. Even though I had a graduate degree under my belt and all the rest of it, all I could see was the age discrepancy. 22, 25. Coming out of college, old man. And that's how I just saw it in my head. And that is what really motivated me to be like, all right, Anas, you gotta move up quick, you gotta hustle. And that actually ends up being an advantage for me because the hustle to catch up, which now I've realized is completely relative, is what helped me be more driven, more focused, more ambitious than the rest of my colleagues.
We're at TransUnion. We realize that we've gotten ourselves into something that we don't have perfect familiarity with, but you had the tenacity and the desire to overcome those challenges. What did you have to do to get yourself into a position so that you could succeed in the role? And what were they asking you to do?
So that is, wow, that deep question. And what I had to do is I had to suck it up. That was just number one. It was, you could whine, you could be upset, you could whatever. It was just, I just need to get good at this. And I have to, there was a lot of running against myself, whereas I have to prove to myself that I could overcome this. So as I was there 6 years, I continually had to prove to different managers along the way that I was ready for the next step. And I would say that was probably a piece that I'm now cognizant of now that I'm a little more tenured in my career, that a lot of times when I'd go for reviews and so forth, my managers would always say, show me what you've done. And now on this side, I'm like, no, it is your manager's role to know what you've done. They should know the business impact, because if they don't know, that's a sign right there. So while I was at TransUnion, there was a lot of being the squeaky wheel, and I completely believe that you have to advocate for yourself, because no one else will do that for you. No one will care for you as much as you care for yourself. So while I was at TransUnion, started off as a data engineer, began coding campaigns, worked with PNC Bank and a variety of different folks, and was showing that I had the chops. And then from there, moved from like an associate level data engineer to mid-level data engineer, and then moved up into more of a client consulting role, because the campaigns and the models that we were creating were super complex. And having to ultimately explain them to marketing teams, who either they were running direct mail campaigns or digital campaigns and so forth, it was a lot of showing to management that I had the ability to do it, but it was also getting management to trust that I could do it. I may make a few mistakes along the way, we're all human, but give me the chance to do it. And once again, it was this piece of, well, you have to work a certain amount of years before you get to the next place. And I think that's absolute rubbish. It is talent over tenure, because you've been here 5 years doesn't mean anything. You could be complacent in that 5 years and just doing the same thing. So for me, it was continually innovating. It was pushing the envelope from, I went above and beyond a lot. I would create PowerPoint decks when no one else in the division was doing that. I would speak to clients in a different way. I'd have client meetings. And everyone's like, you don't have to do that. And I was like, well, I want to do that, because I had this hunger to be better. But it was also, I was doing things that I felt made sense. It was this internal compass that kept saying, these are the pieces that if I were a client or if I were a marketeer, I would want to hear this. I would want to understand this. So there was a lot of an internal compass that was telling me the things that I should do. And I think this is where organizations as a whole, they have to recognize high performers. And if they're hungry, give them more to eat. If they are hungry, push them forward. Give them what they need, because what do you have to lose but a productive employee who will drive business forward?
Something that you said earlier in relation to you being hungry and wanting to prove yourself to yourself was saying you would do whatever it takes. And I think you expanded on that a little bit by saying you created PowerPoint decks, you wanted to present to clients. What all else was whatever it takes?
Long nights. So it was missing friends' weddings. It was staying at work till 10, 11 o'clock at night. It was having my car parked in front of a TransUnion and having the tire stolen off the back. It was all of that. And there was a lot, there was a mental piece in it as well, and just not feeling good about yourself and still showing up every day to work just to have the good fight. And it was also having that dream and believing in yourself. I think this is what, if I took away one thing from acting, it was you cannot allow someone else's rejection be your rejection.
So we're at TransUnion, we're burning the midnight oil, literally burning it.
Literally.
So when is that actually paying off? What was the reflection of that hard work?
TransUnion and Chicago's market is an interesting place, because I always felt like I was capable of more. Even though I had moved up and was doing well, I always felt like there was more. And I could take on more, just give it to me all. And I think when you're that early on in your career and you're passionate, you have to go where the opportunity is. And I think from a development perspective, if you're not getting the opportunity, then you have to see what else is out there. So at this point in time, I was senior client consultant. I was leading a team of marketing technologists. And so it was all going well. And I also had this thing, I was like, there's more I can do. And as luck would have it, American Express was my client at the time. And I had literally just gotten married. And American Express reached out and they said, we would like you to join the Risk Information Management Group to lead our relationships with the credit bureaus. But we need you to start in, like, I think it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So I'd been married for 5, and then 3 weeks later, I had to move to New York. And I did it, which is a big sacrifice when you're recently married, when your spouse is still here in graduate school, and you're in New York, and you're doing this bi-coastal relationship. I was like, I'm going to do it. And went to American Express, and for about couple weeks, my role was to manage the relationships with the bureaus, so TransUnion, Equifax, Experian, to bring their data into American Express to feed into their models for them to make decisioning on different portfolios of credit cards. So similar sort of stuff, because it was still all based on those decisions, how you're going to market to them. But within a few weeks, my VP at the time, still the funniest story, he came to me and she said, "You have a Facebook account, right?" I was like, "Yeah, sure I do." She said, "Great, you can lead digital transformation for us." I was like, "Okay." So
you said, "Okay."
Yeah.
That was your next response?
I was like, "Okay." But it was one of those, you know, when someone looks at you and they give you, they almost, you know what they, you know the answer they want you to give.
Right. There's only one answer.
Yeah.
Answer
so it's yes. Like when someone guides you with their eyes of, "You've got a Facebook account, right?" And you're like, "Yep." So I was like, "Okay." And so I was like, "All right, well, what is it that you want to do?" So the whole premise at that point in time for American Express was they wanted to expand their credit card, their card member base. And they wanted to do it through partnerships with digital platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, and the rest of it, and create unique experiences for a multitude of touch points for a younger, or I shouldn't say younger, but a more diverse audience of a different footprint than they already had. So I worked on developing out what that roadmap would look like. And because I had just gotten there in September, I didn't really have too much vacation. So over the holiday month in December and January, I just, once again, blood, sweat, and tears, developed out what digital transformation should look like. Who should we be partnering with? Why should we partner with them? What's the type of audience they have? How would they connect with their brand and so forth? Put together the transformation for the Consumer Card Services Group, rolled it out, and it worked.
So let's dig a little bit into what you just described about the creation of the roadmap. To me, it sounds like you're now utilizing a new skill set. You didn't have to do that previously at TransUnion, even if you had been building decks and talking to clients and all that. So jumping into a totally new space in a totally new city after this massive life change, how did you go about investigating that responsibility?
A lot of it was online research. I'm a big believer in it can't be too hard. That's a narrative I'm perpetually telling myself, from cooking food to whatever it might be. Oh, it can't be that difficult. And I have a process of when there's a big concept, I break it down instantly. I'm like, what are the workable pieces? I'd say I'm a tactician, just naturally. I'm very much focused on execution. You think of a big idea, I'm already thinking of how you can operationalize it. So the first piece was understanding what was the landscape like. So did a lot of due diligence around, you know, where are conferences we should be, who are emerging platforms. So Pinterest was just coming up, and Twitter was a big, it had already emerged, and we were looking at doing a collaboration with them. Facebook was on the up and up. So there's a lot of these digital platforms that were really starting to gain speed, versus for the group that I was part of, it was still new. Because it's just, they were the demographic of that group. They were older. A lot of them were of different parts of the world, but social media wasn't a thing for them.
And what year is it?
This is 2011.
Okay.
So Facebook had been around maybe 5 years. Same with Twitter. Pinterest had maybe been around 18, 24 months. The digital landscape was still growing. So it went from identifying conferences to then speaking about different partners and the types of audiences that we could reach through them. And then it was also bringing up the piece of, if we partner with these platforms, how does that enhance the customer experience? Because American Express, at the end of the day, they are an experience-driven brand. So had a list of where we should be and then who we should partner with, why we should partner with them. But then there was also these tutorials of how do you use this platform? Because there were folks who had never used, they didn't even know what a pin was. There were some people like, what do you mean you have to pin it on Pinterest? Or so it was upskilling the teams as well, while also speaking about this is the new innovation and this is why we should partner with them.
Even if you believe in yourself and you say the words, "It can't be that hard." Sometimes, not sometimes, you always need to sell it through to the people internally as well. Did you find that you faced any challenges getting people to see your vision, whether because they trusted that you had the vision and you understood digital transformation and what it should be for American Express, or because they were, in some cases, so far behind that they didn't understand what you were bringing to the table?
Yes, is the short answer. And the great thing about American Express is nothing is ever taken for face value. So even though I'm giving this great narrative, there was a lot of rework. There was a lot of, I know that doesn't make sense. There was a lot of fact checking. There was a lot of the thing about innovation, and Amex is an innovative brand, things are continually evolving very quickly. So what was true today may not be true tomorrow. So there was a lot of iteration, and there were moments when it was frustrating because I had this great idea, it makes sense this way, and then today it was good, but then tomorrow, no good, start again. So it was once again just staying the path of, all right, if this isn't good, American Express really forced me to think outside of the box and not to give up, because it is hard when you continually say, no, this doesn't work. Or, but then you're like, well, but it worked yesterday. Why isn't it good for today? And why doesn't the strategy work? So it's just keeping at it and really coming up with a very simple, effective, yet powerful transformational strategy that everyone can understand and see the value of.
So we've chiseled our way to success. Where are we at now for you?
I was at American Express almost 2 years, and you know, loved Amex. It's, in the world of financial services, it is the it's the golden brand to be part of, or the blue box values. It's the epitome of where anyone could be. And for me, coming from Chicago, working off Wall Street, literally where I sat at American Express, my view was of the World Trade Center as it was being built. So I was like, coming from DeKalb, Illinois, where I went to undergrad, home of Cindy Crawford and barbed wire, I'm now here at the financial district of the world. And it was interesting because as I was there, one of my mentors, he was very candid. He was like, Anas, you need to leave. I was like, what? He was like, your energy is going to scare people. He was like, you're a really energetic person. You need to get into advertising. And I was like, dude, I've just been here like a few weeks. I'm not going anywhere.
In relation to you being at American Express.
Yes. What he told me, he was like, it's financial services as a whole, Anas. He was just like, your personality is that your vision, your energy, it will scare people. It's just who you are. It's just how this industry is. And that was hard for me to hear a few weeks into American Express, but that's when the seed got planted in my head. And this was the person who was like, you might want to look into advertising. So generally what I've seen amongst myself and my colleagues is in financial services, within the 6 to 8 year mark, you either stay or you're a lifer. That's it. When I hit my 8 year mark, I watched an episode of Mad Men. And it was the specific episode of Don Draper when he pitched the idea of the carousel to Kodak. And I remember watching him do that, and I was like, I could do that. I could do advertising. I really could. And I had a lot of like conversations with my head of, yeah, that's, I could pitch ideas. I'm creative. I get brand strategy and advertising and marketing campaigns. And then at that point in time, I was ready to try something else, because I was like, financial services is great. I've learned a lot from a work ethic perspective, a data perspective, a branding perspective, but I want to be in an industry that the core business is creativity and innovation for a variety of different brands.
Before you go on to the next point there, as far as trusting that what your mentor suggested was something that you should actually take heed to, what was it that made you trust that?
It wasn't even about trust, because as he said it, I heard him and I was, all right, I've just got to New York. And I sort of shelved it in the back of my head. It was more about the intuition, because as I began doing digital transformation and learning about different partners and platforms and how it would be applied and so forth, I got more immersed into the advertising and marketing ecosystem. And then I was like, there's an entire industry around that. Why am I not part of that? So I could do that for a variety of different players where that's the core business. And so I was like, American Express is great, but their core business is credit cards. And that's not, like, it was great, but it's not where I want to spend the rest of my career. So it was this internal intuition that, and the courage to listen to the intuition. I think that's probably the hardest part, to move on and say, there's something else I would like to pursue, because it was a completely different career trajectory. As I spoke to some of my friends, the first thing folks told me, you're going to have to take a step down. And I was like, no, I'm not. And they're like, no, you're going to have to take a step down. It's a new career, this, that, and the other. And there was a lot of that as that was happening, as I was contemplating the next move. And in my head, and even outright, I was like, I'm not taking a step down. I'm not taking a pay cut. I'm not doing any of those things. I'm going to take everything that I have and parlay it into the next level. And I did that. And I think it's that belief in yourself. But that there's a lot of, I'm very much into giving thanks and having daily affirmations. I think there is something about the universe that when you have these affirmations that are so strong and you believe in them, nothing can get in the way of that. So I went from being a senior manager at American Express to a director at WPP. So I was able to take a step up, even though it was a new field.
I'm going to guess the vast majority of people want to do what you did. They don't want a parallel path into a space where they don't get to have that career jump. But there is both a combination of fear and then the folks that ultimately say, this is the way of the world. You have to take a step back. So what did you do in order to make your vision come true?
This may sound weird, but I prayed a lot, a ton, like I'm a big spiritual believer. And it was just when it feels right. So the interesting thing about going to WPP, obviously I'd interviewed before, like coming to American Express, being at TransUnion, and we know how interviews are. You go, you answer the way you think the interviewer wants you to answer it. And that was the beginning part of my career. When I interviewed at WPP, I met the CEO of Data Alliance at the time, and that was this gentleman by the name of Nick. And for the first time in my career at that point in time, I believed in the person. It was this synergy that I was just like, wow, he gets me, I get him, I understand his vision, I understand what he wants to do with this firm. And what I really liked was I connected with him as a person. So it was one of those meetings. It was supposed to be a half hour or 45 minute interview. Ended up being 2.5 hours, and I walked Nick to the F train. And after that, I was like, I don't care what this job is. I'm so inspired by this person. I believe in the person. I believe in the vision. And this is why leadership is so important. And it was refreshing to see someone see your full potential. And that on its own was so motivating. And so it was serendipity, it was universe, it was prayer, whatever you might want to see it. I had this opportunity and I took it.
So now you're at WPP. What are you now tasked to do? It's your Mad Men moment. What do they have you doing?
So I get to WPP in 2013 is when I began. And that was an interesting time because Publicis and Omnicom had just announced their merger. So there was a lot happening. It was going to be this $35 billion merger, which would mean that they would become the largest combined holding company. WPP would become number two.
Yeah.
So there was a lot around how do we differentiate against the evolving landscape. And what the role I got picked up to do was data partnerships. And so I came in as director of data partnerships, and we had just announced the partnership with Twitter. So got in, and the first thing, they're like, you have to develop out a data roadmap of who we're going to partner with, why. And it was soup to nuts from who we're going to partner with, how we're going to evaluate them, how we're going to put the contracts in place, to how we're going to market this, how we're going to gain adoption across the industry, how is this going to impact business. And I was just one person. And so I was like, okay. So I came up with a schematic of different categories of different data partners, which ranged from mobile data, geolocation data, social data, to video and health data. That was also a big piece. And then it was who falls into these buckets. And there was a evaluation criteria and which countries are they going to be in? What types of data can we use? How can we bring it in a compliant manner? And how do we then amplify that across the organization? So when I see folks such as Spotify and Birchbox, all of these subscription-driven models, I know what they're talking about, because to get people to adopt and to subscribe to a partnership or a platform or a service that you've created, it takes a lot of work, because you have to simplify the value proposition and you have to make access easy. So that's what we're doing for all of the partnerships that we put in place. And then the remit grew to going with Martin Sorrell and being part of the executive team that would speak at Cannes and CES to these folks who'd be on the cover of Forbes and People magazine, like, you know, Jack Dorsey and Daniel Ek and so forth. We'd be talking about strategy. And for a kid from London or from Wembley to be all the way out in the south of France having these conversations, it was a big moment.
Given the magnitude of what you now were not just involved in, but leading, were there moments where you started to question and say, this is getting really big? Like, these are top dogs I'm dealing with, and there are serious consequences associated with the vision that I've created. How did you internalize just knowing that that was the case?
What I learned very quickly, especially when you're in a circumstance like that, you're around some people who have extreme wisdom, extreme industry knowledge, is you have to be very thoughtful about what you're going to say. Every word out of my mouth had to be a value add. And if I didn't have any value to add, I was going to stay quiet. And that was it. So I knew where I could speak and where I could contribute value and where I couldn't. So it was just going into these meetings and making sure that I was on point. And what empowered me to speak was I was probably the only person, as we'd have these conversations, that understood the details down to the contractual terms of reps and warranties and liabilities, to the different pieces of marketing and what the partnership was going to do and the nuances, I understood everything compared to even our partners, because a lot of times there was folks on the front lines who are working on them and then it sort of gets filtered up, versus I was able to go deep instantly. So just being a subject matter expert is what shielded me, I would say, from feeling like, hey, I'm out of my depth. So it was just knowing it 100% backwards and forwards, all the way from sitting down and reading terms and conditions when you sign up for a platform, to understanding it, the value to us as WPP. It was just knowing it better than anyone else in the room.
Someone might listen to this story, maybe a couple people, maybe many people listening will say, and or if they were in similar circumstances, feel, Anas, you've done too much. You're doing too much. You're putting in too much energy. Don't you have a family? Don't you have a personal life? Because as much as the success is exciting, it sounds like there's too much personal sacrifice and maybe too much attention to detail. What is your argument against people who might ingest the story that way?
I would say that they're right. I would say, and I actually spoke at an event a few years back about this, when I began in my career, I wish someone had told me that there is an opportunity cost to everything that we do. And that opportunity cost is time. I chose to do the things that I have done in my career because it just felt so intuitive that I loved it. It was like reading a book that you love, or riding a bike, or riding a horse. I just loved it because for the first time in my career, I was able to come up with an idea and run with it. And having that autonomy and having people believe in you, you like that feeling, and I loved it. And I was very much into, you know, when you're so empowered, you're loving it, and you're in New York, you're in part of the scene, and you're, you know, working crazy hours. And yeah, there were times when I would travel, God, 2.5-3 weeks on the road doing one city every 2.5 days. And it would start in New York all the way over to Indonesia, stopping off at each of our firm locations across the world, crossing both oceans. I think at the end of the day, it's the choices we make. And for me, that was the choice that I made at that time. And I do think you have to be careful about your time because it doesn't come back. For me, that was the right thing to do at that point in time because I didn't know any better. And the other piece of it was my parents came to this country for a very solid reason. You know, like my father's side, they went to Pakistan after the partition and, you know, they did well for themselves. My mother's side, like my grandfather's, was the first mattressing giant in India. And so my parents came from really nice households and came and lived as immigrants starting from scratch. And what I like, everything I have today, this moment that I have, it was put in motion when my father was 18 years old and left Pakistan. And that is such a... it's a privilege, but it's a burden as well, right? Because more people have sacrificed me for me to have what I have, and it's not just about me. So for me, I had to be successful because my father put something in motion over 60 years ago so I could have what I had today. So I think for me, I was just so in the moment. I was in such gratitude for the opportunity because, I mean, I would look back at it. My father came to London when he was 18. He passed away. My mom raised 5 kids on her own. She sacrificed a lot. We did all these home jobs of making samosas and stuffing envelopes. And my mom would sew our teddy bears and sew our coats. So I was like, this moment in my life is what I've been working for and what people before me have been working for. I can't squander it.
I think there's also always a middle ground in terms of sacrifices need to be made. Maybe everyone isn't going to make sacrifices to the extent that you did, and maybe some of them you would have done them differently if you could do it all over again. But to grow as far and as fast as you did, many of those things were probably necessary. So to speak to that a little bit more, what of that work that you did to that, I'll say, extreme extent that you did it too, was really appreciated, embraced, and associated with you and the special quality you could bring to Data Alliance?
So that's what the interesting part of it is. All of it was. And that's why when you're appreciated and when someone believes in you and gives you a voice at the table, and I was very, very fortunate. I've had people who have really supported me, and they've blocked others so that I can make the play. It's completely a game of football, right? They have allowed me to be a wide receiver while blocking everyone else. They'd give me a good throw, I'd catch it and make the touchdown. So it was And I think that was the piece of it that was so motivating, that I had autonomy. My voice was counted. I had a seat at the table. And even when I did screw up, which it happens, the advice I got was get over it. So I was learning as well. So it was just all of it, as it was happening, it didn't feel like work. I think that's really an important piece. So because it didn't feel like work, it didn't feel like a sacrifice either. Because 24/7, I was thinking about the next partnership. I was thinking about marketing aspects. I was thinking about consumers. It was just so intuitive. For the first time in my life, it was who I was and what I did were at one.
You know, speaking to you now being at Data Alliance, we're doing what we want to do. There's appreciation for that work. I heard you say a couple of things as far as having leadership that made space for you to grow fast, to make mistakes, and then also having critical mentorship. Were there some figures in your life that really helped guide you on a path that really opened up doors once you were at WPP?
Yeah, there were several. And I think I've had good role models throughout my life. Of course, I'm going to say my mom, because she's the only parent I have and has raised us to be resilient and has raised us that failure is part of life. But how you get up and how quickly and gracefully you get up is what will define you compared to everyone else. But I think just professionally, it's, you know, like I had my first manager at TransUnion, Michelle. She would never ask someone to do something that she couldn't or wouldn't do herself. So that idea of lead by example was completely there. I think at American Express, I had colleagues who were just so brilliant in terms of being kind, but also knowing how to drive an end result, something like my colleague Nicole. But at WPP, I would have to say the board of Data Alliance was brilliant, but most importantly, Nick Nyhan. Like I said, he had this belief in me that motivated me to do more. And an anecdotal story about like the first time I even ended up at Cannes, he was just like, you know what? You know this really well. You should go. And I was like, wait, me to Cannes? I'd only been at the firm maybe 6 months, 8 months maybe. And I'm like, wait, be with Martin, this great personality, go to Cannes, this is like bougie place. No, 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 I'm not ready. And I had to beg Nick to come with me. I was like, all right, how about we both do it? Because if it doesn't pan out, at least you could take the rest of the meetings. But he was one of those people who forced me to step out of my comfort zone, but he also stepped aside so I could step forward. It was one of those moments that maybe I didn't even step forward, he just stepped back. And so I would say that there have been moments like that, like Harvey Goldhurst and Jacques Van Niekerk. There's been a variety of people who have been really good in giving advice from GroupM and Wunderman and listening to me and also inspiring me to do the right thing while also delivering hard lessons. There's been a lot of hard lessons, but delivering in a way that wasn't soul-breaking, but constructive.
What were some moments where you really learned some critical lessons, either because it was through the work experience or even realizations about your, let's even say, like professional weaknesses, areas for growth that were really meaningful to shaping the future of your career?
So I would say, you know, like throughout my career, I would hear people say, your skill set isn't what we need, and which was always such a blow to me. And I was just like, what does that even mean? Because I never understood that. I was like, I could be anything. I could do anything. Like I said, in my head, anything is possible. Just give me the problem. I'll work on solving it. So I think it was just feedback like that, which wasn't constructive. I realized some of it is arbitrary and you just need to filter that out. I would also say that there are times in your career or in my career where I would see behavior or people that they taught me a lot about who I didn't want to be. And that is just as important as knowing who you do want to be. And so I think it was a combination of those pieces, because, I mean, it's hard as you're coming up. And then there are folks who always believe that what you've received, you are undeserving of. So it's either, oh, it's because you're connected to so-and-so or you know so-and-so. Life is about a value proposition, the value you can provide to someone else, and that's it. And for me, throughout my career, I've always tried to provide a value. Quickly. I think speed is very important as well. So it wasn't about who I knew and so forth, because believe me, the minute I stop providing value, I'll be out the door. And that should be how it is, because it's a business. We're there to provide value. So when people would say that I had received whatever I'd received in great scale or not great scale, because it was based on who I know, I was like, that's not true. I came into this industry without knowing anyone. I came into a relationships industry without knowing a single person. And I did it based on developing real relationships and providing value and being thoughtful, being kind and nice, but wanting to do what's best for the business. That has always been my sincere desire.
Even though this is advice that is commonly touted to say, don't listen to the haters, right? Like, it can be really hard to do in practice when there are real figures that you work with. You could be in an environment where you can sense that they harbor those emotions, even if they're false emotions. What enabled you to really say, I'm not going to lean into these detractors? How did you level set yourself to truly believe?
I think it was Winston Churchill who said, if you throw a stone at every dog that barks at you, you're never going to make it to your destination. And I wasn't looking at throwing stones. I was just, I've got so many other things that I have to get done that I cannot waste time on that, because my days were so long, they still are so long, that I was like, no way. I was just like, I know what I need to do. I'm just going to have that clarity of vision. So it's a lot of filtering out. Unless, you know, of course, there are folks like you, if your leadership team is telling you that this doesn't make sense and you listen to that. But you need to know who you can listen to and you need to know who you shouldn't. And that's just part of the world, because if you listen to every naysayer, I mean, for all the success stories out there, they've been told a million times that they weren't going to be what they're going to be. And you have to learn to ignore it.
You have had data be a touch point at every spot in your career. And now data is trending like it never has before, right? People are obsessed with the concept of data, even if they don't know what it is. They want to say the word data.
Right. So, well, big data, yes.
What are things that you have seen or observed as far as how people are thinking about data wrong?
What I've observed across my career is everyone wants all the data there is out there and they think that's the Holy Grail. And my answer to that is that's wrong. It's not the data you have, it's what you do with it. At the end of the day, we as marketers, we're human and we're trying to emote. We're trying to build connection. We're trying to build a humanity between a person and a brand. You have to think about, if I'm going to use this data, how is that going to translate into something that's emotionally compelling to help drive a decision? And I think that's really, it's that intersection of creativity and data that is really key. It's once I've got this insight, how am I going to now make this into a compelling concept that's going to create a brand that lasts beyond the test of time, if you will? So I think that's the piece of it. The data isn't the end-all be-all. Data is a component of the marketing journey.
You've spent so much time at all these very big organizations, right? We're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. If you lived in an alternative universe in which now you work at a very small startup, how would you go about approaching thinking about data now, knowing you don't have all these resources and other teams to lean on?
A lot of it comes down to relationships. So like I said, data is a component of it. Even now, there are conversations I have with players who are bigger or smaller, and some of them reach out to me, some of them I reach out to. It's about just, if I were at a startup, I would still reach out to people. It's about being fierce and bold, because if you don't ask, you'll never get. So I would still take that approach. I would say this is the value proposition. And yes, you may not get the first door opened, but eventually when you knock enough times, folks will. So I think for a startup or a company that is building itself, continue knocking on those doors to reach out to different places. I think everyone wants to create value into the ecosystem. And we are now in this place in the world where it's not a survival of the biggest, it's survival of the fittest. So streamlined companies, you could be, like I think, for example, like Data Plus Math was 21 people and got sold for $150 million. It's not the size of the firm, it's the value that you're providing.
You've grown so far, so fast. So for a lot of folks who might be listening, they work in advertising and marketing, it seems like you reached the top, but the reality is somebody who's always hungry is always thinking about the next thing. So with that in mind, there are obviously things that you'd like to touch on that you haven't touched on yet as far as your career growth. What are things you're seeking to explore in the future, and how do you seek to prepare for them?
Oh, man. So it's interesting, and I will speak very candidly. When I was appointed CEO of WPP's Data Alliance, at that point in time, I was like, yeah, I'll be honest, I've made it. That was my mindset. And I remember coming into the office and turning on my computer, and on the Inside WPP website, my face was there. And I had that moment of, I don't know if any of the listeners or yourself, if you've watched Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith, when he gets picked for the internship.
Yeah.
He walks outside onto, that was Wall Street. I walked outside into Madison Avenue, and I had a moment. Because like I said, it was that reflection back on the sacrifices my mom, my father, and my four sisters had made for me to get to that point in time. A few weeks into it, then you realize that you've crossed one mountain. There's a whole host of mountains in front of you. There's mountain ranges. And then it comes to, when is enough enough? And is this the direction of life that I want? So I think for me, it is, I will always be hungry and I'll continue to be hungry, but it's going to be about, I want to continue. I'm an emotional person. I want to continue in the realm of emotion. And it's going back to, in a weird way, 360, going back to being an actor, but doing it in this capacity where I'm able to help people connect with ideas and products and services that make their life better. There's so much happening in the world today, politically, environmentally. People are becoming more and more aware of their surrounding, and they want to be part of movements, products and services that stand for something. And to be given the opportunity to help craft that is a really big thing. So for me, I think it's wanting to just continue down that realm of creating cool and compelling messages that when I look at, I'm like, wow, it's brilliant. In terms of how to prepare for that, I think it's A, putting it out into the universe that what is good for me may come to me and what isn't good for me may not come to me, and having that belief. But it's continually pushing myself to follow my internal intuition. And I'm a firm believer that you have to drive your own destiny and just continue doing what's right for the firm, right for the business, and right for yourself, and what's meant to be will be.
So I also have to ask this question. Have you ever come across a mind-blowing insight from evaluating data that you otherwise would not have intuitively picked up on?
So we have a product that we're about to launch called the Inclusion Index. And what the Inclusion Index does is it allows companies to survey all of their employees to understand how inclusive and diverse, those are two separate things, but how inclusive and how diverse they are. And so in that way, because there's a hypothesis that the more inclusive and the more diverse you are, the better it is for business. And as we speak about IND and so forth, one of the most amazing insights that I found is that as we speak about especially gender equality, we have added 40 years to gender parity, which is crazy. We're talking about it. Everyone's like, yeah, men and women need to be equal. But yet in all the talking, we've added more time to that parity happening. So to me, that has been mind-blowing because we need to stop the talk and do something. And I think I think gender is the starting point, but it goes down to race. It goes down to alternative lifestyles, socioeconomic backgrounds, and so forth. But yeah, I think that statistic for me is extremely relevant and mind-blowing because of where we're at today.
Are there any really interesting things that you are leading up at Kantar that are just being led up at WPP in relation to diversity and inclusion initiatives that extend beyond some of what you just referred to?
Yes, there are. We are actually launching an entire inclusion and diversity initiative with Adweek, which will go live in a few weeks, that speaks to an entire practice of how industry leaders can come together and imbibe and infuse inclusion and diversity from a training perspective, from an understanding perspective into their business, ultimately with the premise that more inclusion and diversity leads to better business growth.
How satisfying or gratifying is it for you as a man of both Pakistani and Indian heritage who was born in the UK? How important is it for you to be a part of these types of initiatives?
What's interesting is up until a few years ago, I think I was blind to it all. Coming into corporate America, just very honestly, being raised in England and the US, in my head, everyone was all the same color. And I don't know if I had forced on these goggles, but I'm just as good as everyone else. It's an even playing field. And so and in a weird way, it may have helped me because I just focused on the work and that's what I did. It wasn't until more recent times where I realized that it's not an even playing field. And there are things that have even happened in my own career where I have questioned that if I was of a different skin tone, would this be the same bar that I would have to jump? And I think recently there was a study done by Harvard Business Review that said women and people of color, they have to be more educated and and have more accolades to be at an equal place as a person as a male Caucasian. And to me, when I read the Harvard Review, I was like, now it's become legitimized, but you could ask any person from a marginalized community, they could have told you that. I look at myself, I've got 2 graduate degrees, certification, speak 3 languages, all the rest of it. And there have been times in my career where I've had peers who have not had the same or had the same output from a professional perspective who are further along.
To a certain extent, I would say that my experience is similar to yours, working in this industry for about 10 years now, that in order for me to operate and function as I should, I had to sometimes turn a blind eye so that I could just function in the workspace and function with everybody else. And it's something that I had talked about with a previous guest on the podcast as well, that it just was the way things were. Do you find that now that you are in so many ways a top dog in your own right, that you're better able to have a sphere of influence and create some of that change, whether it has to do with inclusion and diversity or other areas of the business that you personally know is important?
For me, I'd say my role is connecting the right people with the right opportunities. And coming from WPP and being at Kantar, I've been fortunate enough that I've got a very broad network. So as we're doing different initiatives, it's, this is who we should speak to in the network to help amplify what we're doing. So I would say what I'm able to bring is the amplification that is needed for the initiatives that we're working on.
Final question for me, as it relates to obviously a career that was built on data, and I would say that there was some convenient timing around that, right? You got into the right thing at the right time, which ultimately parlayed into advertising. What would advice be that you would want to give to others who are looking to growth hack their own careers and to build from where we're at today?
What would my growth hack be? It would be follow your intuition. So I think for anyone, you've got to love what you do. That is super important, because if you don't, you're just not going to be able to sustain it. Like we were talking about earlier, in the hours I put in, it didn't feel like work. It didn't feel like long hours. It was just something I loved doing. It was exciting. So A, you've got to love what you do, and B, develop your own personal brand in doing it. There's no shame in that. I think earlier on in my career, I was very much of, it's all about the firm, which is good. But as a partner to the firm, people need to know who you are as well and the value that you bring. But yeah, I'd say the top one is love what you do, and also realize that there's an opportunity cost for everything. For me, I've learned it's been time, and make sure that you're willing to give up something in order to get what you want.
You've had a really fast moving, high growth career in the few short years you've spent in this industry. There's a ton for other advertisers and marketers to reflect on as it pertains to their own careers and how they may want to growth hack what they are doing and the trajectory of where they're going. So Anas, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
So that's our episode on growth hacking your advertising career. Thanks to Anas Ghazi of WPP for sharing his story and take on how to climb the ladder quickly in a fast-moving industry. That's all for now. I'm your host, Noor Nasir. We'll catch you next time for more AdTech Unfiltered.